Good morning.
Good morning.
The title of today's sermon is Mother Earth Law, Bolivia. And before we get to that, I think to really understand the fullness of what's going on in Bolivia with the Mother Earth Law, some background is helpful. I think it's also helpful to kind of reflect on who we are as a people and where we are spiritually. And I remember when I was first entering in seminary and then into some of my clinical work, I would receive an application. The first time I received an application, there was a question on the application: what is your spiritual cutting edge? I was a little green at that point, and my first response was, huh? What does that mean? What is your spiritual cutting edge? I had no clue of what that was, which also reveals I didn't have a language for meaning-making and reflection. I didn't even have a language for it. I didn't even have words for it. So I stumbled through the best that I could. But it was one of the best questions that I've ever that's ever happened to me in my life, because it made me stop and pause. What does that mean? What is my spiritual cutting edge? The implication is that there is an edge, and that I'm cutting into something, I guess, or it's cutting, and which means that I'm in a process of change and transformation and bringing more into me and becoming more. What is the cutting edge of my spirituality? So after 28 years of wrestling with that question, I say this is the cutting edge of my spirituality: perpetual pursuit of the freedom of transformation, to engage in a process encountering the wisdom of the world in dialogue with the backbone of my true self. That the spiritual cutting edge somehow means I have some awareness of who I am and what I am at a core, and that I am working through, as we spoke in the last couple sermons, I am working through the coats and the clothing that has been put on me from birth on, and I'm taking those off, getting closer to my truest self to engage in this spiritual cutting edge. And indeed, some of the removal of the clothing that I received at birth and culturally onward, removing that is also a spiritual cutting edge. It's the same process. And a brief example of that is, as a second-born child, I don't know if you're familiar with the family systems. There's a triangle, rescuer, persecutor, blamer kind of triangle. Well, I would be the rescuer in the middle. You're kind of the peacemaker. And you get that script in life. I mean, how many of you know that people who are perpetually the peacemaker, or people, whenever it gets anxious, they make a joke? All these things. These are scripts, and these are scripts that we get at birth. And to take those off is moving closer to our truest self, because it gives us a choice of who we're going to be rather than programmed to who we're going to be. So that could be the cutting edge of our spiritual life. And I can remember when I was in seminary, I went to this judo class and talk about cutting edges of learning. In order for me to practice judo with the adults, I had to learn how to fall with the children. So here I am, I was in late 20s, and 8 and 7 and 6 and 10 year old kids, right? We'd have to run up, grab a belt, and go flat and fall, right? And so here I am, this adult person, doing this with these little kids, and the sensei said, unless you do that, you can't come play with the big guys. So I did it. And in a way, that's what we have to do. So we have to go to the simple to learn the basics. And it was a good thing I learned how to fall, because I fell many times in judo. So that was a good thing to learn. So I did that, and I think that when we try to understand a different world view and a different world perspective, somehow we have to learn to suspend our own. But that's difficult to do, to suspend our own worldview. For example, when we had to move to Amendment, William Kremmel came in and talked to us. One thing that he taught me was that the whole Constitution is based between the relationship between debtor and creditor. And the relationship between debtor and creditor structures our society and our culture. So our mindset is looking at the Constitution, yelling, yay, yay, Constitution, we're supporting the Constitution. But we're also, which I did not know, we're supporting a particular relationship between debtors and creditors. I didn't know that. I didn't know that if I'm so committed to the Constitution, that my mindset was going to be shaped and restructured to fit between the two poles of debtor and creditor. I didn't know that was organizing who I was as a human being in this culture. But the more I read and the more I look at it, it's like one of those things, once you're made aware of it, you go, oh yeah, well that makes sense. So now I've got to contend with our Constitution structures an economic process, maybe not necessarily a political process. And I don't have all that figured out. I just know there's something to it. So how do I find myself in the context that I'm in? And how do I begin to make sense out of this Bolivia thing? What's going on in Bolivia and in Ecuador and in some places in our country is different and from a different mindset and from a different worldview than where I am today. And learning that mindset and that worldview, I might hear words that I understand the words, but I don't necessarily know what they mean. For example, here's a core tenet of this view, worldview, guiding what's going on in Bolivia and the Mother Earth Law. We are the universe reflecting upon itself. We are the universe reflecting upon itself. I thought, wow, that sounds lofty. That sounds nice. But what in the world does that mean? How am I the universe reflecting upon itself, the universe? How am I to make sense out of that? I'm going to put that on the very front of my cutting edge. I kind of understand the words, but I don't know what it means. And I also know I've got to feel the meaning of this. My intuition tells me there's truth to it. My intuition tells me that it's going to be helpful for me as a human being to bring this truth, whatever truth is in there, into my mind and work with it and try to understand it better and try to feel it, to try to really get it within my being. And along with that, and some of this work is from Thomas Berry, and along with that, he calls the universe an emerging process. And that every aspect of the universe is emerging. So now when I hear Halley's Comet, or I hear there's a meteor, or I hear the earth is spinning, or I hear trees growing, or I hear about we found another planet, or we discovered a galaxy that has 800 billion suns. I mean, imagine that. That all of that is part of the universe emerging. And as the universe emerges from this particular perspective, I am an aspect of that emerging. I'm the same as the tree emerging, which the tree is an aspect of the universe. I am the same as the comets moving, and the comets are an aspect of the universe. I am an aspect of the universe as everything else is. How could it be otherwise? We're here. And in this way of thinking, it says that the human being has this unique capacity to reflect and to make meaning. And in the human capacity to reflect is the universe itself. reflecting upon itself. It will take me, I will guarantee you, 3 to 4 years to really have some sense of what that means. But it means something. And it's core to this movement that's going on in our world, really, to try to save the world. It's very similar to what we have talked about historically, about allowing ourselves and our truest selves to simply unfold. And anything that is hindering that, we need to get out of our lives so that we can unfold. In listening to the children's story, I was noticing the addiction wrapping around cookies. Did you notice that? It started out with a cookie, and then there was this whole line of trail, this whole circling around, and it comes back to a milk and a cookie. Yeah, you know, addiction. It wraps around the addictive object you're addicted to. The whole world moves around. You come back to the object you're addicted to. So I was noticing that we train this process early. So if that's there, then the unfolding of myself as an emerging part of this universe, I would need to remove that, shift that, because that could actually hinder the process of the emerging universe. So then I have to learn to live with, I don't know the meaning, but I'm going to dedicate myself to the process. I'm going to dedicate myself to a process in which I don't know the outcome. And if I'm insecure, I can't do that. There's a song by Sinead O'Connor called "I Don't Want What I Don't Have," or "I Don't Want What I Can't Have." Not sure how that works. Okay, and in that song, she talks about going into the desert, and that she's going into the desert. She has everything she needs going into the desert, and she doesn't need anything else. So it's a choice to go into the desert, not out of need, not out of crisis, but out of a sense of being okay. She's going to choose to go in the desert. And one of the lines says, "I'm going to take this road, even though I don't know where it leads." So in a way, I'm there with this part of emerging universe, and I am the universe reflecting upon itself as you are the universe reflecting upon itself. I don't know where that will lead, but I'm going to take that road to try to understand that. Further, Thomas Berry, he says there's three rights. Oh, before we get there, very interesting, because in terms of rights, and we've been on that with corporate rights and personhood rights, and we've spent a lot of time on that, so we have some sense of what that means. And he says that in the emerging aspects of the universe, as soon as something emerges, it has rights. There are tree rights. There are river rights. There are insect rights. There are human rights. There are planet rights. I guess there's comet rights. And he's saying that the tree doesn't need human rights. The tree needs tree rights. The human doesn't need tree rights. The human needs human rights. And that there's a mutual process and a mutual respect between all the different aspects of this emerging universe. And so he says there's three rights. And I think, okay, I'm kind of with this so far. The right to be. I think we would all vote yes. If you're here, you have a right to be. But we don't relate to everybody in the world as if they have a right to be. We relate to people in the world, they have a right to be used. We have a right to orchestrate society to meet our particular needs. We have a right to manipulate people to become a particular way so that my life can be better. But to have a sense that everything and every emergent aspect of the universe has a right to be, and that I have to be mindful not to be intrusive to this other thing that has rights, because I could actually hinder its process of becoming what it was meant to be. In our seventh principle, I was thinking about the word respect. We have a respect for the interdependent web of existence. And when I'm thinking of respect, probably influenced by the recent culture of rap and that kind of thing, we got respect in that. But what the respect means, especially from that, what the respect means is I'll go up to a certain point, and because I respect what's beyond that point, I stop. It's a boundary. When I go past that boundary, I don't have any respect for that entity. I can do whatever I want with it. I can use it. I can ruin it. It's my property. I can do what I want. I mean, we live in a neighborhood where some people are still using well water, and I watch, you know, people bring trucks in and squirt poison all over their yard to kill the bugs, I guess, whatever they're trying to kill. And at the same time, the people down the street are using well water, and there's no thought that that has meaning. But it's my property. I can do what I want with my property. So he says, you have a right to be. Then he says, you have a right to your habitat. You have a right that wherever, whatever is emerging, the habitat in which it emerges, you have a right to the habitat because you needed that habitat in order to emerge, and you need that habitat in order to sustain you. That's a right to clean water, clean air, food that's not laced with hormones, what antibiotic, whatever, that's healthy for you. You have a right to ask for your food products to be labeled, so you know what it is you're eating. That would come under the right to habitat. You have a right to habitat. Next, you have the right to fulfill its role in the great community of existence. I was talking to my father, and he about every 5 years tells this particular story. And he was in the steel, working Bethlehem Steel at Ferris Point in Baltimore, Maryland. And he says when he first got there in the 1950s, what he noticed was that there was a company town, and there were, in essence, company stores, company churches, company schools. And he says that these were segregated, black and white. You had boys and girls in schools, and you had coaches who would coach the kids' teams. The coaches were the managers. The coaches were selecting managers when they were 8, 9, and 10 coming up through the Little League teams. Right? And he stepped back and he said, I was clear, and that was a pretty young age for him, or 20s. He said, I was clear this was like cattle, that we were slotting people for particular roles for industry. And then he said, at the same time, a lot of those people were happy. They had a house, job, and food. And they could go play in the Little League and do different things. So it's a mixture, but to fulfill its role in the community of existence. These are some of the foundational thoughts that are kind of undergirding a movement that's going on, again, in Ecuador and now in Bolivia and in several cities, more than several, bunches of cities in our country. And they were, it's curious because when I first read it, it struck me. The movement is saying that nature has rights. Nature has rights. What does that mean? Nature has rights. I can remember we called him, it shows how childish we are, because this was just a few years ago. He had some guy move in the back of us, and he was from Boca. We never did know his name, because automatically there was this huge, wonderful, beautiful oak tree in the back of, we're here, neighbors here, this is this house over here. This wonderful oak tree's in this neighbor's yard, and this guy comes in, he says, we got to cut down that oak tree because if a hurricane comes, it's going to smash my house. So as children would do, we said he was Boca tree-hating man. That's what we called him. We immediately objectified him, right? I mean, it's a sad admission, I admit. And then he moved out. He's been gone for years, but the oak tree's still there. No thought of what that oak tree might mean to me, to my neighbor. I mean, it wasn't even on his, to the neighbor, or to the squirrels. Or to the birds. I mean, we watch hawks, we watch woodpeckers, we watch cardinals. I mean, all kinds of activities going on in that tree to habitat. Each emerging process, and it gets smaller in our neighborhood, the habitat for these creatures. Two events in Central America that sparked this thing to become a political movement, not just Pachamama religious kind of values of the Andes, which is also a part of the people's movement to do this, but two events really sparked this to become a political thing that's caught our attention. The first event was Texaco in the pristine jungle spilled, how do you spill 18 billion gallons? But spilled, and you might know the story, spilled 18 billion gallons of toxic water. You might notice after the first billion there's a hole somewhere, but nonetheless, that's what happened. And made no attempt to clean it up. Yeah, I think of our culture, and we got both party saying we got to be responsible, and you got to be responsible for yourself and be responsible citizens. And you remember that rhetoric in the elections, the Democrats trying to balance out the Republican, where you get self-responsibility, and Obama's trying to counter that, what he's trying to do. And when I read that story, I thought, it's possible our whole economy is based on irresponsibility. It's irresponsible to spill 18 billion gallons of toxic water in a pristine forest where people live and say, legally, I'm not obligated to clean it up. That's not a good neighbor. It's irresponsible. I'm reminded of Harry Beecher Stowe's statement about the northern people in the fight, the abolitionist fight and slavery. And she said, the North, they like all the benefits, but they don't hear the screams. You know, and I wonder how much I'm like that. I like the benefits of our economy, but I don't hear the screams in that forest. Right? That was one event in Ecuador. The people finally said, whoa, this extractive economic philosophy that comes into our world, pushes our people aside, extracts the wealth, leaves the waste, and goes away. Enough. That was what Ecuador. Bolivia, the second event was Bechtel got the rights to privatize water in Bolivia. And now we hear privatizing water in the United States, and we think we know what that means, but in Bolivia, as soon as they privatized the water, they doubled the expense of water, and really, poor people. It was just a horrible thing. But it got to the point where the corporation told people they could not even store rainwater. True. Rainwater was privatized. So that was what went on in Bolivia. And then you had Morales got elected, the first indigenous person in Bolivia to ever be a leader. Think about it. I guess that would be like a Native American becoming president. We're a little closer. So those two events, and the countries are curious because they'll have peoples, tribes, I guess, for lack of a better term or understanding, that they span political boundaries. I mean, they have countries, but these peoples, they don't have countries, they have territories. And so then they said, all the people, each group needs to have a voice. And so they said, they went to fight in court privatization of water, extraction, people not cleaning up waste. And they went to court in the United States, the same process. They went to court to try to fight that. And what they found out when they got to court, they said they did everything just right, legally, just right. And they went to the environmental protection agencies that they could go to, but they said the environmental protection agencies seemed to support the corporate and not the local people, and which was true. And so what they discovered was, there's no law to stand on to fight that kind of environmental abuse, because to have a law to stand on, that you have to have rights, and if nature doesn't have rights, you can't protect nature legally because nature is rightless, just as slaves were rightless, just as women were rightless. nature is rightless. And they made the point that in every one of those movements, they were all ridiculed in the beginning, made fun of, people persecuted. And so they made the point that when you fight for the rights for rightless beings, entities, you will be made fun of, you will be persecuted, you will be made fool if you do that. So they said, if you're going to take this cause, expect that. So Bolivia said nature has rights and that law is going. And here's just 11. Here's examples of what they're talking about. Okay. 11 new rights for nature. They include the right to life and to exist. Does the oak tree in the backyard have the right to exist? Well, according to this law, yes. The right to continue the vital cycles and processes free from human alteration. That means the Army Corps of Engineers would have to behave differently. Instead of straightening all the rivers and flow of north of the Everglades so they can control them for development, they wouldn't be able to do that, and there would be some understanding that that ecosystem is there for a purpose, filtering the water out as it moves through the Everglades. Human beings could not alter that. Free from human alteration. The right to pure water and clean air. The right to balance, the right not to be polluted. I had to stop at that one. I'm going to have to fight for a right not to be polluted. What's the answer? Yes. Did you know Florida is one of the top mercury states in the country? That by living here we get mercury in our body? It was one of the big issues with the coal plant they wanted to put in down near Port St. Lucie, which the industry guide literally said the smokestack will be so high that nothing that comes out of the smokestack will fall on the residents of Port St. Lucie. I was there. He said that. It's on the record. Thank God for our commissioner. He said, you know, that really wouldn't make us good neighbors, would it? Really wouldn't make us good neighbors to do that. So, after an all-night meeting, commissioners voted no on that. Then they went over to the next county and tried to get it there. So there's no end. If the legal system is not changed, there's no end. The right not to have cellular structure modified or genetically altered. Controversially, I thought, if those weren't controversial enough, they're going to make a point controversially. It will also enshrine the right of nature not to be affected by mega infrastructure and development projects that affect the balance of ecosystems and the local inhabitant communities. Nature to have rights. Nature to have. In our country, in Barnstead, New Hampshire, this company wanted to come in to privatize the water. And the people said no. And the company said, well, we own this, so we can do this. And the people said, no, this is our community. Said, no, we don't want you to privatize. We don't want you to privatize water, take 400,000 gallons out a day and bottle it and send it somewhere else. This is who we are. No, you can't do that. They're the ones that went to the environmental agencies and they said, well, we need your help on that. The environmental agencies were leaning toward the corporations to be able to do that. They said it took, after 7 years of doing everything just right, they lost. And so they asked the question, what's going on in democracy which values local community process, because that is what democracy is, the local community having a voice to control its own way of being. By definition, that's what that's about. Okay. They said, what's going on? And that's when they discovered we have no legal ground to stand on because we don't have any rights. The rightless. So they made a law, and here's just part of it, so you can get this. And this is New Hampshire. Relatively conservative spot on this world. We the people of the town of Barnstead declare that we have the duty to safeguard the water both on and beneath the Earth's surface, and in the process safeguard the rights of people within the community of Barnstead and the rights of the ecosystem of which Barnstead is a part. Yay! Something can be done. It doesn't mean a win, but it does give them a legal standing. It does give them a place to come from. When I read our seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of existence, that begins to remove me from that worldview that's structured by debtor and creditor, and we're going to structure an economic system that is the primary value of our culture. The economic process is primary. I mean, that's what that structure does. Our seventh principle calls us to step outside of that and reevaluate how we live and how we're going to structure our lives. Our spiritual cutting edge. I'm thinking this is our spiritual cutting edge to understand what it means that we are the universe reflecting upon itself. And out of that value system, because that's words and kind of abstract, but out of that value system, when these people, when the Pachamama tribes, when the people from Ecuador and Bolivia, when they take that value and work it into the soil, they come out with new constitutions. They come out with restructuring the legal system upon which we live and where we live. That's where they come out with implementing that particular value system. That's a cutting edge. To change a constitution, which is what they did in Ecuador. Because the constitution is foundational. That's the bottom. That's where everything comes from. And they're saying the constitution we've lived under for years and years and years has got to change because the consequences are dire, which we know. They're dire. So is it, if we're going to honor our seventh principle, is this now our cutting edge to really feel what it means to be the universe reflecting upon itself, implementing and struggling for laws and for rights that we can control our own environment and not to have some kind of process come upon us to tell us how we're going to live in our environment, that we as a local people can decide how we're going to live? Well, I hope to walk with you as we universes reflect upon ourselves. Not even sure how to say that. But that is our cutting edge. We are the universe reflecting upon itself.